yesterday, I described Kaluza-Klein theory and used the explicit example of just reducing with one single extra dimension, where we imagined the extra dimension was periodic, and we could think of it as just an extra circle. And in that case, we saw a direct interpretation of this geometric extra circle as a manifestation of the U1 gauge symmetry in electromagnetism. And so we ended up with something that looked like Einstein-Maxwell theory. So I want to build on that today by talking about the black hole solutions in Kaluza-Klein theory and talking about both magnetic and electric black hole solutions. So in Einstein gravity, when you add an electromagnetic field, you get the Riesner-Nordström solution, which is a charged black hole. So you can have either electric or magnetic charge on your black hole. So obviously they're different from the perspective of the gauge group, the gauge field, but from the geometrical perspective, the effect of adding electric or magnetic charge is the same. So you just add a Q squared on R squared piece to the gravitational potential, to GTT. It changes the causal structure of the black holes, but essentially they don't care whether it's electric or magnetic charge in four dimensions. So let's see what happens with these black holes. So the last thing that I argued yesterday was that motion in that fifth direction had an interpretation of charge. We kind of looked at identifying if you had an extra periodic direction and if you identified both before and after a boost, these were not the same things. So I was trying to sort of argue, I think when I'd done the codimension one defect, I'd said that we could always choose a gauge in which you sort of separated out the perpendicular distance from the object. Once you periodically identify, that's no longer the case. So in order to construct an electric black hole, I'm simply going to take the Schwarzschild black string and boost it before identifying. So that is the black string, but I've replaced dt with the dt primed underneath a Lorentz boost, and the d psi with a d psi primed under a Lorentz boost. So this is what we would get if we took a black string, we boost it at some velocity v, and then we do our periodic identification. So this isn't quite in the form that we want. Remember when we write our five-dimensional geometry in Kaluza-Klein form, what we do is we have a four-dimensional geometry, but we take our extra dimension psi and we kind of complete the square so that we have something that looks like d psi plus a dt, sorry, a mu dx mu. So this is what we get if we kind of multiply those brackets out, collect together the psi pieces, and then complete the square. So the bottom line is the extra dimension piece, the Kaluza-Klein piece, and the top line is our four-dimensional metric. So this was our G hat, which we then did a conformal transformation on. Sorry, there should be a 1 over 2 G on our output here. So we can see that the top line is kind of familiar. It's not unlike the Schwarzschild solution, but it is different because now GT, you know, the TT and the RR components are not just simple inverses of each other. So what we kind of would like to do is to have this looking something like a Schwarzschild potential. And you can see that there's this combination, 1 minus v squared r plus 2 gm v squared that crops up here, there, and also here. So if we wanted to interpret this, for example, as an electric potential, so if I look at this piece and just think about it a moment, then my electric potential would be something like q over r dt. So this suggests that I need to redefine my radial coordinate and then define my charge to be proportional to mv. So I'm going to change my radial coordinate so that I simply re-zero it, which no big deal there. Then if I look up here, I can see that I would want to define my charge as 2gmv over 1 minus v squared. So now I see how velocity in that extra dimension is giving me electric charge. So in that sense, this tells me that A is indeed q over r hat dt. And then just to finish off, I'm going to define a new sort of Schwarzschild type parameter, m hat, which is going to be gm over 1 minus v squared. So you can see that this term now becomes 1 minus 2 m hat on r hat. So remember that our four-dimensional sort of classic Kaluza-Klein metric was not actually this G hat, but the conformally rescaled G. So this is my four-dimensional metric. So remember, ds4 squared was what was proportional to g, and this g was equal to, this g was equal to omega to the minus 2 g hat, which was e to the root 3 phi g hat. minus root 3 phi d hat. So now we've got something that looks a little different. Our GTT is here, 1 over GRR. But what's happening here is that now our hat is no longer the area of the spheres. So in Riesen and Nordström, we often look at the extremal limit where we take M goes to Q and the two zeros of GTT merge. Here, the extremal limit is when Q goes, or VQ goes to 2M. And in this case, in our extremal limit, we kind of see that this VQ here, Q goes to 2M, our horizon actually becomes singular. So this is one of these sort of examples where we take a massive object, we boost it, and as long as we're always below the speed of light, what we have is some sort of, you know, just simply a boosted version of our original solution. Here, our boosted version has a slightly different interpretation, but nonetheless, you know, it's still, whilst V is not one, the whole thing is still just a sort of boosted black string. However, as we go to this extremal limit, what we're kind of doing is we're taking the speed of the boost to one, but the mass of the object to zero, but in such a way that we neither get something, you know, trivial in the sense of we don't get an M equals a flat space solution. And in this case, we get a singular solution, but you don't always. So, I mean, there's a sort of classic solution in 4D gravity of boosting a massive object. So that's the electric black hole. But now I want to talk about a somewhat more interesting solution, which is the magnetic black hole. So in Riesen and Nordström, our electromagnetic field strength is Q sine theta d phi. So this corresponds to a radial magnetic field. And because our black hole has an event horizon, we never see R equals zero. So we never have to worry about the fact that this object is singular or not defined at R equals zero. So this here is the area form on S2. And the energy momentum tensor of this electromagnetic field is exactly the same form as the electrically charged black hole. So the geometry is the same. So let's just think a little more about what's going on if we try and import this into our five-dimensional setup. So the F that we have is what we've called closed. So DF is zero. We kind of expect that from our half of the Maxwell equations. But it's not exact. So when we say a form is exact, that means that we can write it as the exterior derivative of a form of lower rank. Now, you might think, but hang on, surely, you know, this is a Maxwell field, surely I can write F is dA, okay? So your question should be, what if I take that to be my gauge field? That satisfies F is dA. So why isn't that an example of an omega? Well, the reason it isn't is because this A is, whilst I've concocted it to be regular as theta goes to zero, it's actually not regular as theta goes to pi. We often forget that theta equals zero and theta equals pi are coordinate singularities, and we never actually bother to go to local Cartesian-style coordinates. We always just say, oh, yes, we know about that. It's the North Pole or the South Pole. But strictly speaking, whenever we're dealing with a coordinate singularity, what we should do is go into a chart that is locally non-singular at that place, and then look at objects in that chart. So for this A, which is why I've labeled it AN, this A, if we go to theta equals zero, we can go to a local Cartesian system and have an A in our local Cartesian coordinates. But at the South Pole, A goes like 2q d phi, and that is not a regular form. We cannot transform that into some regular expression in local Cartesian coordinates. On the other hand, I can take a different A, which is regular at the South Pole, but in that case, it's not regular at the North Pole. So I can choose my gauge field, if I'm interpreting this as a gauge field, to be regular either at the North Pole or at the South Pole, but not both. Now, given that this A is simply something appearing in a five-dimensional geometry, what this is really saying is that I have a coordinate expression that's regular at the North Pole, and I have a coordinate expression that's regular at the South Pole. That's fine. That's just reminding me of my charts on my manifold. So all I do is take a look at the coordinate transformation between the North Pole and the South Pole, and hopefully that's going to be well defined and something that's sensible. So the north and south A's are related by a gauge transformation, because remember, a gauge transformation is just D of a scalar. So this is both, this is my electromagnetic gauge transformation. And in order to see what my coordinate gauge transformation is, I need to know what my solution is. So this is obviously my charge Q, and the solution was found back in the 80s, I think, by Gross, Perry, and also Raphael Sorkin, who's here at Perimeter. So you can see again, all of these are quite samey. You know, they all have sort of Newtonian style potentials, R minus R plus, 1 minus R plus on R. They also have two horizons, not really two horizons in this case, but they have sort of two special radii. So the second, the existence of the R minus, tells you have a charge there. And in this case, you see that whereas the area of the two spheres grows as you go out to R equals infinity, the sort of length of the extra dimension, which psi labels, just tends to 1. So that's why it's a Kaluza-Klein compactification, because you have 4 big dimensions, that's the top line, and then you're adding an extra dimension, which is never infinite, it's sort of bounded in size. So in this case, it's just the length L, which is the periodicity of the psi coordinate. So what's our coordinate transformation? This is the north patch. So to get our south patch, we simply have to use the fact that our geometry's got to be the same. And so this tells us that we redefine our psi coordinate in the south to be our psi coordinate in the north plus q phi, well, 2 q phi to be precise. So we can either view this from our GR, geometrical perspective, we're viewing this as a coordinate transformation, but we also kind of have this interpretation as the gauge transformation on A. Now, since this has to be a legitimate coordinate transformation, remember that on overlap of charts, we have to have C infinity transformations between our different coordinates. This also has to respect the periodicity of phi and psi. So psi is periodic with periodicity L, and phi is periodic with periodicity 2 pi. So that means if I go to phi plus 2 pi, I must get back to the same point. But if I go from, if I take phi goes to phi plus 2 pi, my psi south is now psi north plus 2 q phi plus 4 pi q. So that tells me that 4 pi q has to equal some integer multiple of L. Otherwise, this coordinate transformation will not respect the periodicity of the coordinates. So we have to have that to be the case. And now what that's telling you is that charge is quantized. So this sort of peculiar solution, just looking for a magnetic solution and asking that the the manifold is a sensible manifold, tells you you can only construct these solutions for integer values of q, integer multiples of some basic amount. And so that is n times l over 4 pi. So this was why actually Dirac first looked at magnetic monopoles back in the 1930s. So he was kind of not quite sure what he was playing around with, but he was looking more just in the context of electromagnetism and was saying, well, what happens? You know, what would happen if there was a magnetic monopole in nature? We never see a magnetic monopole. Why don't we see a magnetic monopole? And so, you know, sort of looking at this type of argument that's over on the left, which is much more expressed in terms of gauge fields. And he sort of noticed, well, I can define a gauge potential. It'll give me a magnetic monopole, except it's going to be singular along the South Pole. So he kind of lived with that singularity, which we call a Dirac string. But then he said, if this magnetic monopole is sensible, then I should be able to find wave functions on the background of magnetic monopoles. So he looked at his Dirac equation on the background of the magnetic monopole. And in order not to get sort of these phases from going round this Dirac string, he had to impose that the monopole had a particular integer multiple charge, which was expressed in terms of the electric charge, or alternately, if you have a monopole, electric charge is quantized. So that was why Dirac got quite excited about the possibility of magnetic monopoles, because just the existence of a single monopole in the universe tells you electric charge must be quantized. So that was sort of slightly odd way of coming to quantization of charge, but it's, otherwise we just have to take it that electric charge is quantized, or, you know, fundamental charge somewhere is quantized. But this is a kind of, you know, an interesting little curious argument as to how you could think, come up with a notion of quantization of charge. It's sort of trying to make magnetic charges coexist with electric charges. So, here we've sort of done it from a geometrical perspective, but Dirac sort of took this gauge field perspective. It's kind of quite nice, one of these sort of nice mathematical ideas, cute little things. So I got a question yesterday about whether in Kaluza-Klein theory you always just have stitched on this extra direction, the psi circle. Was it always just a simple sort of direct vibration? And so this is a perfect example now to come back and ask this question. Is this a simple S1, just tacking a circle on to the background four-dimensional manifold, this top line? Are we just simply adding a circle? In other words, is the topology of that thing R 4 cross S1 or whatever when you've got a black hole? So I'm going to consider this question in the extremal limit, which is when we set r plus equal to r minus, which is equal to q, and I'm going to take a charge 1 monopole. So q is equal to L over 4 pi. And I'm just going to redefine my extra, the coordinate of my extra dimension so that it looks more like an angle. So it has periodicity 4 pi rather than some arbitrary length. So then if I look at that limit for my metric, something kind of interesting happens. T just becomes a proper time. It's sort of a proper time-like distance. And our spatial part of the metric is, it sort of, you know, looks a little bit like one of those Euclidean black holes, but we know it's not quite because it's actually got, sort of got four spatial dimensions. And it's not quite because, I mean, some bits of it look the same and some don't. So we have a dr squared over 1 minus r plus on r. And it sort of is like the Euclidean black hole because here we have something where if that r plus squared wasn't there, we'd have 1 minus r plus on r times the dt squared. But of course, there are sort of subtle differences sitting in here as well. But it's kind of something similar to the Euclidean black hole. So I just, with that sort of thought, I'm going to be drawing some analogies later. Just keep that sort of thought in mind. So let's kind of dig a little bit more into what's going on. So if I just look at, you know, that relation on the top, in each, I can think of what I'm doing when I'm taking my Kaluza-Klein compactification. I could think of it as a hemisphere in a turn, in each hemisphere in turn. So in the north hemisphere, I can imagine I'm taking the top of my two-sphere, the theta and phi directions, and I'm simply adding a little circle. So I sometimes think of this as like chainmail. So you're making some chainmail. So you add the circle fiber with an S1 on the northern hemisphere, and you do the same on the southern hemisphere, but now you have to do the coordinate transformation between the two. So that's where this twist comes in. You're identifying the southern, the angle around that little circle in the southern hemisphere, with the angle in the northern hemisphere plus a twist. So at phi equals zero, you're just simply gluing the two circles one on top of the other. Then as you move round, you glue them with a twist. So you go all the way round the equator, and eventually you've glued with a full 2 pi twist. And that's something non-trivial. So although each hemisphere in turn can be kind of interpreted as something straightforward, as you glue the two patches together, you've done that with a twist that's distinctly non-trivial. So in order to see the effect of this, I just want to kind of step to one side almost and just think about and one possible interpretation of these angles. So what I want to do is I want to look at flat R4. And I'm going to split my R4 into two R2s. And then in each separate little r squared, I'm going to choose polar coordinates. So overall, rho is the length in R4. I split cos and sine to get to the first r squared or the second r squared. And then I take polar coordinates in each r squared. But I'm kind of labeling one polar coordinate to be my chi. Remember, chi has periodicity 4 pi, so chi on 2 has periodicity 2 pi. And then the other one is phi with this extra chi on 2. So if I ask what is my flat metric, then you can see that dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared plus dw squared, obviously I get a d rho squared. And then every other thing tends to have a half in it, so I get plus rho squared on 4 d theta squared. So that's kind of taken care of the rho, cos, and sine theta on 2. But then I also get a cos squared theta on 2 d chi squared, and a sine squared theta on 2. Times d chi plus 2 d phi squared. So if I multiply out this lot here, you can see that I've got cos squared theta on 2 plus sine squared theta on 2 d chi squared. So my g chi, if you like, is 1 in there. Then I look at completing the square. So in that sense, here I've got 4 sine squared theta on 2. So I add my 4 sine squared theta on 2 here, which is simply 1 minus cos theta. That's my cross term. And then finally, when I look at what I get for my d phi squared, here I've got four sine squared theta on 2, and then I have to subtract off this term squared. So you see that this is 4 sine squared theta on 2 cos squared theta on 2, which is just sine squared theta, this term. So what I've got is I've got d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared plus this angle piece here. So I actually have something that would look the same as this if this R plus was the same as R. So this whole thing here is actually the unit metric on a three sphere. It has to be, because what we've done is we've done it in perhaps a slightly different form to what you've probably usually seen, but our rho is a radial coordinate. It's the proper distance out from the origin in R4. So what we have left must be a three-sphere metric. So theta, phi, and chi are the Euler angles on S3. So in our case, we can see that what we do, what we have is sort of an S3 structure, but not quite. So what we've got is something where, you know, we, on the right-hand side, we've got a nice round S3, so that as you went out to rho equaled infinity, the whole sphere would become big. Whereas on the left-hand side, we're allowing part of the two directions of the sphere to become large at large r, but we're restricting the third direction. So what we've done is we've distorted our sphere. We've kind of squashed it. Sorry, S3. So what we have, our metric has symmetries SO3 cross U1. So it's a squashed S3. So as R tends to R plus, if we define a radial coordinate rho by a rho squared is 4r plus r minus r plus, so remember the Euclidean Schwarzschild in that case. Then you will see that in fact we end up with that metric on the right hand side. So that's where I say there's an analogy with that Euclidean Schwarzschild solution. Our Kaluza-Klein monopole is topologically R4. So just like the tau R sections of Euclidean Schwarzschild were topologically R squared, this thing is topologically R to the fourth.
Cylinder that we have
in
Binder-Nostrum, plus one more.
So, locally, yes. Okay. So as R goes to infinity, locally, we have something that looks like the little cylinder tacked on. However, globally, we're not dealing with something that's R squared cross R1. It's actually a squash. It's topologically S3 at fixed R, always. It's just that it's not metrically S3, it's a very, very squashed S3. So it is a Kaluza-Klein because we have a small S1, and locally it's literally just like a little circle sitting over where we are. But as we go around the whole of the three sphere, we see that these circles don't quite, you know, match up. They come with a twist, and that twist enhances us to from a two, S2 cross S1 to an S3. So this is an example of a hot vibration where you take a vibration of one manifold with another, and rather than just getting simple one manifold cross the other, you actually end up with a sort of enhanced structure. So since I had a couple of I've had some mathematical questions after the lectures, I thought I would take a slight detour now to talk a little bit more about the S3 after the question.
So what do you mean by the monopole is four dimensional?
Oh, R5, yes, I've forgotten. It's this, yeah, so that piece, the spatial piece is R4. So the monopole itself is R5, thanks.
But I mean, I think of a monopole as a point.
Topologically, though. What is the space-time topologically? So, for example, our Euclidean Schwarzschild is topologically R squared cross S squared, and the S squared is kind of telling you about the event horizon, which is sort of has spatial topology S squared. Metrically, it's not R squared cross S squared, because we have that cigar that I sketched. So the geometry doesn't look like an S, you know, sort of this R4. The geometry is something highly distorted. But nonetheless, topologically, it has five real directions that are infinite.
You mean of the event horizon?
No. There is no event horizon. That's the point. There is no event horizon in this case. What we've got is a, if I go back to this, what we've got is this flat time direction times an Einstein Euclidean manifold. So a Euclidean Ricci flat manifold. So when I first sort of was talking about adding extra dimensions, I was saying, well, if we have a four-dimensional Einstein solution, we can always translate it in a fifth direction. But in that case, I was thinking the fifth direction was space-like. Here's an example where we have a Ricci flat four-dimensional Euclidean manifold, and we are adding a time to it. So it is a solution to the 5D Einstein equations, and it's a non-trivial solution. But it has space-time curvature or spatial curvature, but it's not. You know, it doesn't have mass because there's nothing in front of dt squared. You know, it's an unusual manifold.
Well, if you say that it's topologically R5, whatever, then does it mean that R equals zero is just coordinate zero?
That's right, yeah. It's the origin of polar. Mm-hmm. So we get trained into thinking of 1 minus r plus on r means there's an event horizon at r plus, right? But here, t, there's nothing happening in the time direction. And in fact, if we just chosen different coordinates, we wouldn't have, you know, we would see that there was nothing wrong with r goes to r plus. So here I've just chosen the simple rho squared coordinates regularizing a local apparent singularity, but you know you could choose a different radial coordinate, which was a proper distance right from r equals r plus out to infinity. It just wouldn't be as nice.
This is only for the screaming t.
This is only this. The manifold has only got no event horizon and is R5 only for the extremal case. But what I said about the topology of constant R sections is the same even in the non-extremal case, because up there you can see that, you know, you could kind of look and say, well, okay, if I fix R, I've got two different factors in front of the d omega squared and the deep psi piece, but I can, those are just scalings. So all I would do would be I'd fix R, I'd have to sort of think about what my psi was and probably just rescale it. But I would still have that same kind of Euler angle structure to my space. So S3, I thought I'd just say a few words because it's kind of fun as a manifold. Is an example of a group manifold, and it's an interesting manifold, because what does that mean? Well, it's obviously a manifold because I've sort of expressed it up here talking about geometry, but it's also actually a group because these coordinates that I chose are the Euler angles. So a point on S3 corresponds to a particular rotation in SO3. So it's kind of one of these, it's sort of, you know, just an interesting manifold. It is itself. So you might think, okay, when I have S2s in my metric, that's sort of a manifestation of SO3 symmetry. So if I've got S3, surely that's telling me I have SO4 symmetry. So strictly, I should say it's SU2 because we sort of write our R4 as C2. But it's actually quite interesting because it has two actions. This sort of at the group level, SU2 is like SO3 cross SO3. So it has two. So what do I kind of mean by that? What I said about our metric was that it had a symmetry SO3 cross U1. And that is the squashed S3. So when we have a round S3, that means it should have even more symmetry. So it means our S3 has a bigger symmetry than SO3 cross U1. And in fact, it looks like SO3 cross SO3. So let me just write something down on that. So you've probably seen the SO3 algebra of Killing vectors when we're just dealing with our two-sphere, in which case you just block that out here. So this would be your Xi1, Xi2, Xi3. So in this sort of manifestation of the SO3 algebra, we're kind of picking the phi angle to sort of be our basic. This is where we have, if you like, our quantum number associated with J phi, JZ, right? So to get a second group, of Killing vectors, I've labeled the other way around. So what I do is I take phi and psi and swap them, but with a minus sign. So I get a second set of Killing vectors that have the SO3 algebra. So in our case, our SO three right, this is to do with whether you act on the right or the left as the group action, is broken. So our psi right three would be d by d chi. So all we're left with is the d by d chi. We break the SO3 down to a U1, and that's our manifold. So it's kind of, it's just kind of an interesting thing. I encourage you, if this is the sort of thing that you like, to go and read up a little bit on it. And it's sort of nice to just sort of see this connection between thinking about our sort of group structure of some of the symmetries of a manifold translating directly into symmetries of this, you know, this S3. So in this case, we've taken an R4 with an S round S3, squashed it to give us still our SO3 cross U1 structure, and there's also geometries with just pure SO3 symmetry and not the extra U1. So in the last couple of minutes, I just wanted to just make a sort of note of caution. I've talked a lot about different solutions. I've talked about sort of black holes, black brains. But I've not actually discussed whether or not these are sensible solutions. In other words, are they actually stable? So to just explore this, I'm going to look at the very simplest case of the black string, Schwarzschild cross R. So that's my black hole horizon, and I can, my mass is simply, if I go to infinity, I just simply get the ADM mass, my four-dimensional ADM mass, which is R4 over 2G4. The entropy, on the other hand, is the area, 4 pi r4 squared times the length, divided by 4g5, which goes like g4 m squared. Now let me look at five-dimensional Schwarzschild, which is just a hyperspherical solution. The mass here was given by that formula that Myers and Perry found for us. And the entropy is again just the area of the event horizon which I re-express in terms of mass. So if we look at the two different expressions, I've got one that goes like m squared and one that goes like m to the 3 halves. So you can sort of see that as I change the mass of the black hole, that's going to change the entropy of the black string versus the black hole in differently. So it seems as if there could be a threshold where one is preferred over the other. So what I'm going to do is just compare the two entropies to see when, you know, one is bigger than the other. So I'm just changing the G5s in the entropy of the black hole into G4Ls. So you see that overall I've got an M on the, a root M on the bottom, a root L on the top, or rather a root G4M on the bottom and an L on the top, plus some numerical factor, 8 over 27 pi. So what this tells me is if the length of my extra dimension becomes larger than some factor times the horizon size, then the black hole is preferred. So for small extra dimensions, that means that generically you would rather have a black string in your extra dimension, but for large extra dimensions, you'd prefer to have the black hole. So if I just sort of, so this is L. G4M is 1/4 the diameter of the black hole. So here, when, not very good at drawing, am I? Is that L 27 pi on 8, 3, 10-ish? No, I'm okay, I'm safe with that one. So in that case, that would be stable. But something like this, for example, is not stable, and entropically, it would prefer to be something like that. So this is, you know, this is just using these sort of very woolly arguments of black hole thermodynamics, but it's arguing that there is a tendency for a black hole to want to change its shape. And indeed, you can go and look at the perturbation theory around the black string, and you find that there is an linear instability to the formation of black holes. So this is just an indicator of instabilities of higher dimensional black brains that seem, you know, it's quite generic. Here I've just given it in terms of the black string, but it's also the case for anything but extremal black brain solutions. And so it's something that sort of happens in higher dimensional gravity that sort of says that even though you can find all these wonderful solutions, unfortunately, they tend not to be stable. So that's just a word of caution. Yeah. Well, you don't. So people have looked at this numerically, and they found, wobbly black holes. Solutions that have some non-trivial dependence in the extra dimension, but those tend to have higher entropy again. So Louis Lehner, who's here at Perimeter, and Franz Pretorius actually followed through the evolution of this linear instability and, sort of produced plots that make it look very much like you get, this fragmentation into black holes. So that was, this was an instability that was first found by myself and Raymond Laflamme, who's also here at, in Waterloo, back in the early 90s. So it's one of these sort of curious things, because whenever you see a horizon fragment, what it's indicating is that instantaneously you have a naked singularity. So that's something that typically in classical GR is a bit of a no-no. You always want to hide your singularities behind event horizons. So this is the sort of example of a classical process that would appear to violate, this censorship of singularities. But it's also curious because it's an absolutely classical instability, and yet you are led to looking for it because of an argument using black hole thermodynamics, which would appear to be a sort of rather quantum mechanical type of argument. So sort of one of these things where another reason why we actually think there's something deeper in black hole thermodynamics. So I'm going to let the guy come in and clean the boards.